So I'm going to invite Dr. Imogen Coe to share her screen. And for those people who aren't aware, Dr. Imogen Coe is the founding dean of the Faculty of Science from 2012 to 2018. She is currently a professor of chemistry and biology at Ryerson University and affiliate scientist at St. Michael's Hospital, Toronto, where her research group studies drug transport proteins. She is the current president of the Canadian Molecular Biosciences Society and sits on various boards. In addition to her work as a research scientist, Dr. Coe is internationally recognized as a Canadian thought leader in the integration of principles of inclusion, diversity, equity, and accessibility, particularly into science and medicine. She advises academia, government, and industry on best practices and approaches towards inclusive excellences and has contributed to national dialogue about these issues through various platforms. She is much in demand as a speaker and panelist and has received numerous awards for advocacy work. So we're really delighted to have her here today. So whenever you're ready, please take it away.
Great. Thanks very much. It's a huge honor to be invited to a physics conference as a cell biologist. And I've been listening in and trying to follow along a little bit, but I'm really thrilled to be here. I've got two screens going and I'm not sure which one you can see. Can you just see the first slide or can you see the slides along the bottom?
We could just see the first slide.
Okay, excellent. All right. So this is me. The title of my talk, Uncomfortable Truths and Inclusive Excellence in Academic Science. And I'm a big fan of social media as a way of engaging and being active in this area. And so you can find me on the interwebs. I have crossed out the name of my institution because some of you may be aware that recently, there's been ongoing discussion around the naming and the role of sort of colonial systems in Canada, and I'm sure it's going on in other places. And Ryerson is named after someone who was instrumental in the residential school system. And so many of us at the university who are engaged in aspects of social justice have decided to recognize that this is an issue we need to be involved in, even though we're scientists. Science is not apolitical. Science does not take place in a vacuum. And so that is why you may see some people from that institution with the institution's name crossed out. But that is to say, I do have great respect for where I do my work at my institution, and it's in the heart of Toronto. That's the Dish with One Spoon, One Palm Agreement. Here is our Indigenous elder, Joanne Dallaire, with the wampum. It is a different kind of thinking about governance. It's a different way to think about policy and governance. And it brings together people in this area, in this land, to share things like resources, share care for each other and for the land. And these are really good sort of foundational principles to think about when we're thinking about creating really enriched environments where people can bring their full selves and do their best work. We tend to think of these things as being historical, but where I'm actually working from home right now, which is just outside of Toronto, I'm actually on disputed treaty land. And that disputed treaty was only finally settled and signed off in 2018, so very recent. And this was a treaty that actually talks to the issues around resource allocation. So these are ongoing issues that we need to be thoughtful about when we're thinking about who's in the room, who's not in the room, who's contributing to the work we're doing, for instance, in creation of knowledge. Now, I'm a scientist, I'm a cell biologist. Why am I talking about issues around social justice or about equity, diversity, inclusion? And I would encourage you to add the A in there, accessibility. I would encourage you to close caption all of your events to ensure that people who have accessibility needs are also accommodated. I've done all the things, I've had the passion for science for as long as I can remember. I've done all the things that you do as an academic scientist. I work on drug transport proteins, how things get in and out of cells, published, gone and got grants, run a research team, done all of those things, and been able to build a very satisfying career. But at the same time, from as far back as I can remember, I have been very aware that not everybody got to follow the path that I was able to follow. And even I couldn't follow some of the things I wanted to do because I was told at an early age, well, girls don't do this or we don't include. I had a great passion and aspiration to go work for the British Antarctic Survey. I wanted to go work at the South Pole, do environmental sciences. But at that time, they didn't send women to that particular research center because it was stressful for the men working there. And so that really closed off a door for me. And so I saw people being selected or excluded on the basis of characteristics that had nothing to do with their ability. So like a DNA strand, in parallel to my passion for science, I have had this ongoing work, activity, acquired expertise, and total immersion in the scholarship associated with the activity of science. How does science work? Science is done by human beings. And I've published in this area. I've developed policy. I've informed and advised whole groups of people, groups of organizations, particularly in the biomedical sciences and medical areas, because I'm a biomedical scientist. So I have a lived experience that I can bring to that. But for those of you in Canada who maybe apply to NSERC and you have to write that EDI statement for your HQB section, then if you, you know, struggle with that, then you can either thank me or blame me for that, because I've also advised on policy around integrating EDI and A into our research enterprise. So that comes from a long background in the area. And there's no reason why anybody else in science can't immerse themselves in the scholarship and really become educated. And I encourage everybody to do that. I've also been a hiring dean. And so as a dean, I've got, you know, a faculty with scientists from across the spectrum. And this is a little cartoon that you may have seen from XCD, you know, about the different cultures of science. And I can tell you, as a dean that had chemistry, biology, computer science, math, and physics in my faculty, there are cultures of science. Different groups of scientists have different traditions, different cultures. Nothing wrong with that as long as you have the self-awareness. So I think when we're talking about EDI and A issues, we need to really be honest about the fact that science is done by people, people who come from different cultures, different contexts, and disciplines that have cultures and contexts. And for example, the difference between scientists who have a fixed mindset, which study and research and evidence and data tell us tend to be fixed mindset tend to be over here, physics and math, you're either a math person or you're not, whereas the growth mindset tends to be over on this side of the spectrum, which is more, yes, practice, failure is an opportunity to learn, there is the possibility to develop those skills. And so that can have huge implications on who actually makes it into the discipline and who doesn't see themselves as being capable. You know, obviously, you know, we can argue about the meaning of knowledge and the epistemological philosophers there will tell you that they hold up all of you. I like this one where the nihilists are actually tickling the philosophers, and you know, it's all a bit dodgy there. And ultimately, you know, it's turtles all the way down anyway. So I mean, we can talk about the meaning of knowledge and how we think about knowledge. And I sometimes think we get distracted by that. I want to come back, I want to make sure that we focus on the fact that science is conducted by humans who are inherently biased, not because they're bad, but because evolution and neuroscience has given us that kind of brain, and that we do science within societies that possess structurally embedded sexism, racism, homophobia, ableism, and colonialism. We've just seen it at my institution. And we can't actually understand the world around us to the best of our ability. We can't achieve the highest level of understanding our world around us and within us without really calibrating against the fact that we have this maybe cognitive dissonance, that we have this these structures that are biased, just as we would have machines that we would want to make sure they're fully calibrated that we before we use them in our experimental design. This is one more, this brain up here is one more aspect of, it's one more tool that we want to use to be sure that we're getting the very best. So we want to make sure that we really acknowledge how we do science so that we can get the best out of people and get the best outputs. This means that we got to face up to some uncomfortable truths. There's no way around it, right? It's uncomfortable to say, wow, yeah, we're all biased. I'm sexist. I'm racist. I have huge privilege. I'm white. I have a British accent that carries an advantage for which has no basis in my ability. And so, you know, there are some uncomfortable aspects of the world we live in and ourselves that we're going to have to face up with and learn not to get defensive, unlearn a bunch of behaviors, and be open to learning new skills and sets of ideas and ways of doing things. Some of you may be aware of this quote from Stephen Jay Gould, which really speaks to the fact that some people out there with great talent are not in the system. We're not leveraging the brain power that we could on the basis of barriers, of socioeconomic barriers, of sexism, racism, and that we are missing. We're missing things. We're not getting as good as we could. So we're missing talent due to the complexity of the barriers. It's not one thing. It's a systems thing that we have, which means we need systems interventions to address them. Exclusionary behaviors and the myth of meritocracy. And this is the fantastic Grace Hopper, who's foundational to the field of computer science. Her work was very important. And she said the most dangerous phrase in our language is, we've always done it this way. And I can tell you the number of times I have heard that when I have challenged a policy, or where I have challenged an outcome, or where I have challenged a hiring report, or where I've challenged somebody saying, but you know, we've always done it this way, as a reason for not doing something that will actually remove a barrier. Just because we've always done it this way is never a good enough reason. I grew up just outside of Cambridge in the UK. And you know, speaking of we've always done it this way, Cambridge for over 700 years always was an institution that was designed by rich old men for rich young men. Until the middle of the last century, when women were given access. And for some reason, we are wedded to this model of the Eurocentric medieval university that was built on a system that was deliberately exclusive. That was the design. It's not a bug, it's a feature. And so why are we so married and wedded to this kind of structure and claim that this is absolutely the best we can get? It's good. Maybe there's good stuff in there and you make sure that you remove those barriers, but it's inherently, you know, let's ask the uncomfortable questions. Is this really as good as we can get? And so, you know, we know what kinds of talent was missed. There were Mary Somerville and Ada Lovelace. Obviously couldn't go to university, but were foundational in various aspects of science, but they were rich white women. And so they had advantages and privilege that poor men didn't. My father, both my parents could not have gone to university in the UK were it not for the Butler Act after the Second World War, which opened up the universities to people from poor, lower socioeconomic classes. So they were poor kids, but they did very well in school. They got to go to university, but 30 years earlier, they wouldn't have been able to. And we have in Canada this kind of idea that, oh, this doesn't happen in Canada. Canada's kinder and, you know, more progressive. Well, no, not at all. And we have examples in Canada. Some of you may be aware of the Black medical students at Queen's. Queen's was actually quite progressive in that it accepted Black students at the turn of the century, and then post First World War, Black students, there was a sort of a backlash, and Black students were actively asked to leave. They were asked to leave. So this is structural racism in academic science, technology, engineering, medicine, and math. And this is the student, Ed Thomas, who actually kind of rediscovered this story. And this policy had not been officially removed from the books at Queen's until 1997 or something like that. So this is structural barriers that prevent talented brains from accessing and pursuing passion and from accessing their talent. And so you have to develop policy, you have to develop approaches and be intentional about actually addressing these barriers. So identifying and removing barriers will lead to inclusive excellence, but we have to ask those uncomfortable questions, we have to self-reflect, and we have to be intentional about creating cultures of care that enable and encourage people to bring their full selves to work and do their best work. You're doing great work at CAPRA collecting that quantitative data. I would really also encourage you to collect qualitative data. Why do people feel maybe anxious about presenting? Because subjective experience can lead to objective insights. And so quantitative and qualitative data together can be very powerful. We also need to require higher expectations from our leadership. So this is really, it is the leaders, it's the people with power and privilege who have the most responsibility to do the work. It is not on girls to get interested in science. It is not people of color or people with disabilities to work harder. You know, it's not the burden of the historically excluded or the underrepresented. It is the responsibility of those overrepresented. And here's an uncomfortable question. Rather than talking about who's underrepresented, start asking the question of why is this demographic overrepresented in this discipline? Why is this demographic overrepresented? Let's talk about that and let's try to identify that. And that requires self-reflection and education. It requires removal of offensiveness and an openness to say, you know, that's actually a really good question. And maybe I need to think about whether I have privilege, not to say I didn't have challenges in how I was going to do things or how I was going to get ahead, not to say it wasn't hard work, not to say I didn't work hard, but the challenges I had were perhaps not on the basis of the color of my skin. So it requires a real sense of sort of self-awareness and sitting with that discomfort. This applies less to your discipline, but in other disciplines, we also need to have a higher level of experimental rigor when it comes to thinking about equity, diversity, inclusion, and accessibility in our experimental design. So we've been not rigorous enough. We need to be more rigorous about saying things like, you know, are you using male and female mice in your studies? Do you know what the sex of your cells is? Are you thinking about all the people that are going to be using your product? Are you thinking about the planning? Are you thinking about all the different aspects of the experiment that you're doing or the project that you're working on? And the reality is, if you have more diverse teams, you actually end up getting more of those questions. So if you have a very homogeneous team, many of those important questions will get missed because you've got groupthink. So higher levels of rigor in experimental design actually help everybody. For example, the osteoporosis research is very gendered. And as a consequence, osteoporosis is underreported in men. And so, you know, this is a great website if people say, people want examples, methods, case studies, design thinking, more relevant to other disciplines. So this is just a figure from a paper that just came out where we talk about, you know, what's happening when these narrow ideas about, let's say, for instance, hiring are applied. And so we know that skills are distributed across the spectrum of humanity. There's no math gene that only shows up in white men. That ability is distributed. And we have some kind of cutoff for excellence that we measure in a specific way that is flawed. And we define through our hiring practices that can be very narrowly defined and not EDI infused, a sort of a window of who we're looking for. And indeed, we want these people who are above this level, and we've got four positions over 12 years or something like that, or 1 year. And we end up looking for people who maybe not quite as good because we've got this very narrow window that we're looking through and we're missing people. Whereas if we actually really are intentional about going out and infusing our processes with EDI and A, we can be identifying excellence across the board. And if you're not embedding principles of equity, diversity, inclusion, and accessibility into your processes, you're almost certainly embedding mediocrity. And I would say, you know, people down here. Now, I just realized that there's a problem with this figure, even though it's now published, which is that it sort of sets a ability as a fixed mindset. And actually, we know that ability can be developed because if you apply a kind of a growth mindset, then actually people can upskill quite well. And so we need to work on that. So the problem with scientists, and we're all like this, is that we all think we're objective and our professional identities are big on being objective. And, you know, I was trained this way, we're objective, we don't have emotions. Being emotional as a woman in science is a bit of a weakness. I had people advise me on that. Don't, you know, be careful about your tone. Don't talk about your family at work, all the things that, you know, back in the day, to some extent, sort of limited participation and a sense of belonging. And yet we are human, and we need to be aware of our humanity. There's nothing wrong with that. Humanity in science actually empowers science. And if we have that kind of self-awareness, we can actually calibrate against our inherent bias and thus our inaccurate outputs, for instance, in hiring. People get sort of a little anxious about implicit bias sometimes, but as a neuroscientist, I have a PhD in neuroscience, and I actually have a PhD in evolutionary neuroscience, I can tell you that evolutionary biology and neuroscience explain bias. Brains are wired. Brains have evolved to make shortcuts. Brains are very fallible. But it worked, right? Evolution selected for it. It makes sense to go and find people who look like you when you're being chased by that saber-toothed tiger. There's good evolutionary biology. It's not because we're inherently evil, it's because we're human, okay? And we're not gonna change that, but we can learn to recalibrate both in terms of how we think about who does science and how we actually do the science, which is the integration into experimental design. So it's really about knowing ourselves, knowing yourself, and then recalibrating to take that into account, to really take your humanity and say, yeah, I'm going to use that as part of my experimental sort of approach, but I'm going to make sure it's calibrated. And so if we take all of the things that we know out there that are slightly biased, and we think about it kind of in an experimental format, now this is for chemists, so, you know, this wouldn't necessarily apply to you, but we think that we are selecting through our various processes, for instance, in hiring, for instance, in papers, for instance, in conference presentations, invited speaker invitations, for all of those things that we consider to be meritorious. But we know from a ton of data, each one of those things, CVs, is slightly biased. Letters of reference is slightly biased. And if we add up that slight bias over and over again, we can't possibly be sure that we're going to get the very best out at the end. And our brains are part of that. So all of the things that we know are slightly biased, we want to just recalibrate based on research, based on evidence, based on data, and that includes us. We tend to focus a lot, and I find physics focuses a lot on gender. Nothing wrong with that. So there's some major challenges around gender, but please don't forget that there are all sorts of other barriers and prejudices out there. I doubt very much whether Stephen Hawking would have got the attention at Cambridge if he had already arrived in a wheelchair. He didn't start out using a mobility device. He ended up there. And 20% of Canadians have a disability of some kind. It's the most the most unemployed sector in terms of demographics. And so be aware that if it's such a challenge as a person with a disability, and it could be somebody who is neurodivergent, it could be somebody who has a hearing deficit, it could come on later in life, or a visual impairment could have come on later in life, that you want to ensure that you're still a place where those people can bring their full selves. My great friend and colleague, Dr. Mahadai Sukai, literally wrote the book. Here it is, Creating a Culture of Accessibility in the Sciences. We published a paper in January about inclusive and accessible conferences. And think about the fact that you don't have to be a member of the demographic to be activist in it. So this is my great friend and colleague, Anthony Bonato, who is a mathematician, who, when I was speaking at this gender summit a few years back, tweeted this, which was, as a gay mathematician, I was always on the outside. I never had role models, advocates in my career. And because I had set EDI as a priority for my term as a dean, he now felt that there was somebody there who was on his side. So be an advocate. Allyship is weak. Be an advocate, be an accomplice, be a co-conspirator. Work for positive change for your colleagues. Think about where your conferences are being held. Both Anthony and another colleague have declined invited chairs and invited speaker roles at conferences because they were not going to be safe. One time for Anthony, it was St. Petersburg. He was not going to go to Russia. For another person, another friend of mine, it was Kenya. She was not going to go to Kenya, where they had just enacted regressive, repressive laws around the LGBT community. So I think what that says, and think how that impacts somebody's CV. So they have to decline an opportunity for a very prestigious role in their discipline. And that's really, you know, devastating. So challenge the status quo, ask uncomfortable questions, have courage, depends where you are in the system, in terms of how safe you are. So you can do something at your level. Expect leadership to do more. Leadership matters. Leaders should model EDI-infused behaviors. Pronouns should not be an issue. Celebrate events. Change the walls of old white guys. Be supportive of inclusive events. This is what leaders should do. And have expectations, like set the standard. This is not an add-on. This is just normal to have a conference code of conduct. Obviously, you had. I can tell you that a few years back, was a big fight with another organization that had some physicists in it who didn't want a conference code of conduct because they didn't want people telling them what they couldn't do. You know, think about seminar series, think about policies and processes. It might depend on your collective agreement. And for trainees, there's a huge opportunity for upskilling. This is a set of skills that we need to be working on to support our trainees, things like bystander training, what is still called allyship training. This is a set of posters produced by undergraduates at my institution in support of sort of allyship and being an active bystander. And so there are many, many different things that you can do. It requires doing the work, okay? And it is, I know Leanne said you don't have to do the work, but it requires doing some work on yourself and taking a look in the mirror and saying, how did I get here? You know, what were the things that got in the way? Or did I have anything that really got in the way? Or could I just pursue my passion without, you know, having to think about it? Be honest, ask uncomfortable questions of yourself. Think about the values you came in with and think about how you are rethinking or building a positive environment for others coming along behind you. Assess policies and process through an EDI&A lens. You can do self-reflection as an individual, as a group. Listen. Just listen. And finally, just remember that this work is hard work, okay? It's hard work, and leadership should recognize and reward this work. It's part of the workload, particularly in institutions. It tends to fall on people who are maybe lower down in the hierarchy. It should never be entirely dependent on pre-tenure faculty or trainees. It is the work of everybody. It is particularly the work of leadership. It should be core competencies. People shouldn't be in leadership positions if they don't have this skill set. And people will push back. If people aren't pushing back, then you're not doing anything. Okay, so be strategic. Being polite can mean being conflict avoidant. Canadians have a bit of a challenge around here. Very polite is actually sort of passive aggressive. And we all have some level of privilege which we can use to affect change. Discomfort is good. This work comes from U of T, from the brilliant Sarah Kaplan. And it comes out of often business schools. Discomfort actually leads to more innovations, more challenge. So when you get uncomfortable, you know, it actually can be a sign of something productive, not conflict, hostility, but actual, oh, I'm a bit uncomfortable, and let's interrogate that and let's think about it a little bit. You have to practice, but it's worth it. You actually get better outputs and get more innovation, and in a sort of an economic sense, that can actually lead to increasing and improving the bottom line. So thank you very much. I think I'm still on time, and I'm looking forward to hearing what Anna's going to say. And if there are any questions, I'd be happy to try and answer them. So thank you very much for your attention.
Thank you, Imogen. I'm just going to give a clap there because since everybody else is muted, I'm sure we're all clapping at our screens. So with that, we're going to open up the floor now to questions. Does anybody have any comments or questions, or let's get as much information and tips we can out of Dr. Ko while she's here.
Okay.
Okay, we have our first question. George, I'm going to ask you to unmute. Hopefully you can speak now, whenever you're ready.
Can you hear me?
Yes, you can.
Two things. One, I am part of a non-traditional approach to this subject. I have no degrees. The only time I went to school was to teach and to do research at the University of Wisconsin in Madison, in the physics department there. As a veteran, I have been in combat. And one of the things that I learned very quickly, when you're under fire, the identity of the person next to you is less important than their ability. Mm-hmm. And to be clear, even though I come from a non-traditional background and I am disabled, I'm missing my left leg below my knee. I haven't run into any barriers, even though I have no degrees. So just wanted to put that out there.
Thanks for sharing your story. Thank you.
Yeah, it's nice to hear that people sometimes get through with no barriers. Okay, our next question is from Pretty. I'll ask you to unmute. Whenever you're ready, you should be able to speak.
Hi. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can.
I am Preeti Shreya from India. And this is my first... I'm sorry. This is my first time in any platform where I can listen great people who are working in quantum gravity or gravity or something. Thank you for having me and giving me the opportunity to listen such great personalities. And this is my first time. I am undergraduate student and I am studying. And one more thing, the lady, I think, correct me if I am pronouncing her name wrong, Imogen Kaur. Is it right?
That's right.
Oh, thank you. Thank you. I listen you very carefully and with, I'm hesitating to tell, but I am from a very different background. Most of my family member cannot understand what I am going to do with my study, but I love to study physics and especially gravity. So I'm thankful you people to allowing me here. I have nothing to present right now because I am studying. And one of the person I am seeing, it is Lee Smolin, sir. Thank you, sir. I don't know. I'm thankful. I'm thankful. I am from India. And thank you all legends here who are giving me a lot of things to study and to learn. And I'm following Lee Smolin sir on his paper. I don't know how much I understand. I am just trying. And,
thank you.
His paper. Okay. Thank you. Thank you.
Thank you, Pretty, for sharing and welcome to the community.
Yes, we try to be as inclusive as possible with this year's CAPRA. So I'm glad that you're finding benefit out of it. I'm going to read some comments that are coming up on the chat. So Davide, I don't know if you want to turn on your screen and share and ask your question out front. I feel, Davide, I have to unmute you. My apologies. Okay, you should be able to speak.
Hey, thank you very much for the talk. It was great. I was thinking, this is maybe it's more a question on neuroscience because it's not really, you know, what I study. But you were saying, of course, I mean, to correct biases with, you know, research-based evidence. I guess my question is, we produce the research-based evidence. And now, so someone in the chat was saying that there's, you know, rigorous statistics behind it. But I guess the questions you ask to a, you know, in a statistical analysis, that's important. So aren't we, you know, that evidence we should use to correct biases, isn't it produced by the same brains that are biased in the first place? And if yes, I don't understand. How do we get out? Does it make sense what I'm saying? Okay. Maybe I'm overthinking it. But.
No, it's an interesting question. So I think, remember that the field of neuroscience, I mean, the field of neuroscience is massive. We also have the advantage of evolutionary neuroscience. So we can look at how the brain has evolved and how behaviors that are underpinned by structures and biochemical pathways have developed. So there's a lot that is known about the associated behaviors that can be, you know, that comes from a full understanding, not just of the human brain, but of how the brain has evolved over time. And just like with climate science and just like with evolution, it's not a single or a small group of papers that we're looking at. It's a huge body of scholarship. And so I don't say, do you believe it? I say, do you accept the weight of the scholarship and the research in support of this understanding or this explanation of an observation? And so, you know, so yes, psychology has a, you know, a reproducibility crisis, but we can also look to things like behavioral economics. We can also look to sort of sociology. What is it that motivates people? How human behavior is not rational at all. And so we can actually interrogate it. You know, we can use ourselves as our study animals and ensure that we are actually taking the body of scholarship and the body of research before we draw conclusions, which is really where I come from. So yeah, of course this is bias, which is why we must continually recalibrate all the time, and we are looking to the community to test the results that come out or the interpretations of the results that come out.
Thank you. Davide, any recourse? Okay, you're trapped again, are you?
No, I mean, neuroscience is very fascinating. I would love to understand more. I don't, but I would love to.
Me too.
Okay, we also have a comment from Hilary C. in the chat. I'm giving you the option to unmute if you also wanted to comment on this.
I don't have that much to add, apart from... if you want to dismiss the existing research, you need to come up with an alternative explanation for the observed correlations in the data. If you don't have that, then all you're basically making is argument from incredulity. And that's a logical fallacy.
Thank you. Okay. That's much better than what I said.
Yes. Thank you, Hilary. Okay, we have a few more hands up. Anton? Vizenko, I'm giving you the option to unmute yourself.
Yeah, thanks. So just give me a moment.
Okay, we can jump to Lee Smolin and come back to Anton if he needs a moment. Lee? You should be able to.
There we go.
There we go.
Thank you very much. Thank you very much for your talk. I just wanted to comment on Davide's question, because I think that in my experience, in my observations, there is a relationship or there's a correlation between who has been excluded from the academy, and I'm thinking, of course, of Blacks and women, among others, and who has more original ideas and who is willing to risk more with ideas. There's not always such a correlation, but there is often, and we could talk about why, maybe because people who are in the excluded zone have less to risk and take bigger risks with their ideas. But I think that that correlation tells me, and this is my experience, that when you open the door to such people, you get surprised. at least I've gotten many times surprised. And I think that that there's nothing that is, that better convinces a skeptic than somebody who's an extraordinary scientist, but doesn't look like them. But you have to have the impulse to open the doors, and that's where I think all the data and work you've done is essential. Thank you.
Absolutely. Thank you.
Thank you, Lee. I'm going to invite Anton to also have his comment.
Yeah, thank you. I actually have two questions. Should I ask them like in a row or question-answer?
Sure, ask your first question.
Okay. The first question was actually like on the beginning of the talk, there were references to the past, to the history, which is as we know it is obviously racially biased and sexually biased and a lot of different biases, and how I wanted to know about our position relative to the past and to the, let's say, the perfection. How far have we come, and how far do we have to go more? What is our current state, and how is it better than it was, and how is it worse than it should be?
So I would say that it depends on the discipline you're looking at, and it depends on which country you're in. I would say there are significant differences between Canada, the US, the UK. I think Canada's probably a little bit more like Australia. I don't know where everybody's from. There are parts of Eastern Europe and the Middle East where physics is much more normalized amongst across genders. But there are socioeconomic barriers, so it's rich girls and boys as opposed to boys and girls. So it depends on the context, and all of this work almost is always context dependent. So if you want to ask, you know, what was it like before and where are we going, then you kind of have to define the boundaries. So what are you talking about? You're talking about a discipline, you're talking about a region, you're talking about a country or whatever. I would say, look at the data in Canada, we can say over the last 30 years, there's been really almost no shift in the number of gender, if we look at gender binary, because we have really crappy data in this country, no real significant shift in the number of girls engaged in STEM, broadly defined, which is a horrible definition. So again, kind of low grade quality data. And I think that people have been pushing the model, which is it's a pipeline problem, which is a wrong model. It's the problem is that it's viewed from a deficit approach, which is that we have to fix the women because there's something wrong with them. When you shift that deficit approach to one where you actually address the culture, then you can see quite rapid change. And an example of that might be a number of research institutes, for instance. There's in the biomedical sciences, there's one in Australia, and there's a couple in the UK where have actually intentionally done this, and they've seen a very significant shift in who is engaged and who is coming to them and who is staying with them. So in some places, not better than it has been, and in other places, better than it has been, moving towards the representation we might see in the population. So, you know, white people in the US make up about 60% of the population. So so you might expect to see 60% roughly, you might expect to see the disciplines reflected, given that there's no evidence that there's an ability, you know, concentration in a certain demographic. So we might be expecting to go towards that kind of representation. And really there are relatively few places that are like that. You have to layer onto that socioeconomic factors. So it depends. Computer science is a really interesting discipline because there was a massive increase in the number of girls engaged in computer science because culturally it was considered to be kind of a sort of administrative discipline. So in the 50s, huge increase in enrollment in computer science amongst women approaching medicine and law and this trajectory. There's a great book called When Women Stop Coding. And then in the 80s, those enrollments crashed. And why is that? Well, one interpretation of those data is that the rise of the PC in the early 80s that was heavily, heavily marketed as a toy for boys, and the whole culture around kind of tech bros and everything in the 80s really started to discourage girls as seeing themselves reflected there. So, you know, doing really well in computer science in the 50s in North America, and then it crashed. So, and now numbers are really deeply problematic, and we're seeing the problem with AI and machine learning, all that kind of stuff. So, depends where you are.
Yeah, I also like the story from Ruth Ginsburg's reply to this when she was asked, like, how many people should they have on the Supreme Court?
Yeah.
Or how many women? And she said, I'll be happy when they're all women, because it was all men for so long and nobody blinked an eyelid.
Right.
And that's when you really know you've got all the bias is gone.
Yeah.
Okay, I'll ask Andrea Grimm, did you want to make a comment? If not, we might jump. I'm giving you permission to.
So I also had this second question. I was also a little bit, let's say, conflicted. I mean, I see the contrast between all the presentation and the one particular slide. I believe that was the last or one before last. So, if I understand correctly, the idea is aimed towards lowering the discomfort of underrepresented or systemically oppressed people, like lowering the discomfort of Black people to aiming to go in science, or women aiming to go in science, or other people. But on the last slide, there was this statement that discomfort is actually good, and we should pursue the discomfort because it makes more challenging, more results. And I wanted to know why is it conflicting? Why is it contradicting? Why does this statement contradict the idea in all capital of lowering the discomfort?
Right. So perhaps that's my, I didn't make it clear. So it's not, so let's separate the lowering discomfort. Let's say we're aiming to create cultures of inclusion. So create cultures where people feel welcome so that they're not excluded. You could define that as discomfort, but I would say it's actually more exclusionary. The discomfort part really comes from the challenge to the status quo. So perhaps I should make that clear on that slide. The discomfort is when you disrupt status quo, when you disrupt groupthink, participants who come from the established system will feel discomfort. And that is something that you have to sort of, you have to sit with, and that discomfort can actually be productive. So it's not that the discomfort of the people that are excluded. That's not the discomfort we're aiming for. We're aiming for the discomfort associated with the disrupted status quo. We want to include people and make them not feel excluded. And we want to make the dominant system uncomfortable. So that's a good point. I'll have to sort of maybe clarify that on my slides, that they shouldn't be in conflict. They're two different concepts.
Yeah, so probably it could be a language issue, which is another thing to think about when you're actually talking about these concepts, which is that people are coming from different linguistic traditions, and words matter, and they could mean different things, and they can be understood in different ways. So we need to work on that as an inclusive culture.
Theo, did you want to, I see your hands up, I'll invite you to unmute.
Thank you. So thank you for the excellent presentation. It's obvious, and you sort of emphasized this in your talk, that people of who kind of look like, you know, people with my demographics seem to step up and shoulder a lot more of the burden, to and not that it's not the responsibility of of women, of sort of marginalized peoples to do this hard work. I had a strategic question that I don't actually, that like came up in other discussions and I just don't know the right answer to, which is that I'd love for you to kind of comment on, which is how do you say, it can be actively harmful to sort of go and tell some ornery, possibly sexist person, for instance, oh, go do a gender study and see for yourself, because they might do it wrong. Mm-hmm. So how do you get them to how do you avoid the people who are already have all these sort of have extra to burdens from having to be responsible to kind of fix the work of the other of the rest of us?
So, I mean, that's a great question. And I think we have to remember that there's a spectrum of understanding, right? And there will always be the dinosaurs who will be left behind, and there will always be the leading edge who is pushing, the positive change. And in between, there's a whole variety of people who are at different places in their own journey in terms of understanding. So depending on where you are in a system, if you think about organizational culture, depending on where you are in that system, you have different levels of safety and security. So I wouldn't, you know, graduate student's not going to tell a senior professor, stop being a sexist, misogynistic, racist person, because they're not safe to do that. But, you know, a peer might do that. I would even question whether that's a useful use of their time and energy, because there are some people for whom you're not going to win over the hearts and minds. So let the people who will not change be. Give them extra work in other ways, because they're not going to do this work, but they shouldn't get an advantage for not doing the work, right? Which is why leadership is really important. And focus on shifting change where you can. We spend so much time on trying to educate people, thinking that if we educate people, they'll all get on side and it'll all be rainbows and unicorns, and it won't ever happen. There are still people in Canada who do not support same-sex marriage. They never will. But if we sat around waiting for them to get on board, we would never change anything. And in fact, the most effective way to get the behaviors you seek, which is what you really want, I don't care so much about hearts and minds, I want the behaviors to be inclusive. To get the behaviors you want is actually to legislate, then regulate, and then incentivize. And education is actually number four on the list of what makes people do things. So there are the sort of interventional points that you can focus on to shift an organizational culture towards one that creates a culture of care. And what you have, what ability you have to be able to do that is going to depend on who you are and where you sit in an organization and what opportunities you have. So that's why this kind of self-reflection, self-awareness piece is so important, because you got, you know, don't waste your time going to go tell the old dinosaur that they need. And it could be a she. Like, senior white women have a lot of internalized patriarchy. They can be huge gatekeepers. Lots of data on bullying by senior white women in science. So don't focus on those people unless you're confident that there's an opportunity for a productive conversation, but maybe focus on something else and use your time there. So it's really knowing the organization. It's organizational cultural change and systems intervention, and then figuring out where you fit in that piece and how you can best use your privilege.
Thank you. That was very helpful. And I think the like shifting other burdens to them is a really important insight that I had missed. Yeah. Thank you.